I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in downtown Baltimore. This episode, I begrudgingly watched Killer Sally on Netflix, and I want to talk about it, and I'll tell you why I begrudgingly watched it. I'm glad I did watch it, but it took a minute for me to, wrap my brain around it. But anyway, I will go deeply into it. I will say now that I do want to share a trigger warning. I'm talking about, intimate partner violence, lots of violence, lots of references to intimate partner violence, as well as child abuse. Yeah, it's a lot of references to that because of the nature of the story. And so if this is not something you want to listen to, I will put a marker in the show notes when I'm going to start talking about Killer Sally. So I won't reference it anymore. I'll just go right into the next segment when I'm ready for it, which will be like the way I talk in these intros, it'll likely be like 20 minutes from now. But anyway, I'll put a little timestamp in the show notes. But anyhow, I want to talk about a number of different things before I get to the main topic today. But the main thing I want to talk about first, where do I begin? Interview with a Vampire has really shaped out the series, the ABC series, or not ABC, AMC series, has really shaped out to be way better than I could have ever imagined it to be. I thought the 1994 film was good. Flaws and all, I thought the 94 film was good. And then I began to watch this. And then I listened to podcasts about, you know how the HBO shows, they always have the companion official podcast. And from my perspective, it's hit or miss, right? You always have people who are fans of the subject matter, or at the very least, like the source material, if it's like a fantasy novel or something like that. And you definitely have admirers of the actors who are working on the project. But, and so, you know, sometimes it for me, it feels hit or miss, because at the end of the day, what is a HBO podcast, a HBO sponsored podcast about the show that is airing, not HBO, but a network, my bad, a network podcast that is sponsored by the show that it is pushing out? Is it ever going to be negative about the show? Certainly not. Or about the product? Certainly not. But to the degree that it has deep, meaningful conversation, that's where you want to live. And so I would say this, HBO doesn't always do the greatest job, but actually none of them always do the greatest job. But what I will say is that this one is done pretty well. Anyway, so I've listened to the podcast. I've even begun to rewatch the episodes, because I shared before when I reviewed episodes 1 and 2 that they did a good thing when they included the Black experience in New Orleans. Because I will say this until I can't speak anymore. And even I will say this until I am no more. When you let cultures tell stories the way that are in a way that is unique to them and their experience, my dear, oh my goodness, the flavors that are added are more nuanced than you could even imagine. We've heard this story before. Some of us have read it. Anne Rice was very imaginative, very descriptive too. And you know how when you read novels, sometimes, you know, when they're adapted into TV or film, that they don't always live up to your own imagination. What you're creating in your own mind when you're reading these very descriptive stories about, or descriptions about, these larger than life characters. Do you know how difficult have you read Anne Rice's telling of Lestat himself, the vampire Lestat? How Lestat even says his own name? How vain Lestat is? Tom Cruise did a good job as Lestat in the 94 film. He did. But baby, was it Sam Reed? You can't hardly compare the two. Louis, Le Pont du Lac. It's a completely different character to the one that Brad Pitt played. And I can't call the name of old dude. But Grey Worm. Who, oh my goodness. I don't know who I'm more mesmerized by. Louis or actually, it's Louis. Louis is the one that's pulling us in there, because what's old dude's name? The reporter, who's now played by the older actor. Anyway, their exchange is phenomenal. Like, ain't nothing like somebody who know what they doing. And it's clear in these scenes that these two actors know what the heck they doing. Like, one is not, they're not too proud to act one way or the next. Like, these two people are clearly, like, acting for, like, they brought their A game when they're acting. And you love to watch it, because you almost, you know it's good acting when you forget that you know this story. Or rather, that you know this story and it don't matter that you already know this story, because you're just in it. I think it was the smartest move in the world, because you know what always bothered me about Interview with the Vampire being set in New Orleans, at least the Hollywood depiction. I didn't realize that watching the film and being a child, sneaking and watching it on HBO, or at one of my friends' houses who had it on VHS. I was too young to be watching it then anyway. And so, of course, I missed these nuances. I wasn't even thinking about intimate partner relationships, because I was too busy. That wasn't even something that was in my mind. I wasn't even thinking about it at the time. I was too young. I was a child in 94. But, oh my goodness. I didn't even know that they were gay. And actually, So let me start there. Didn't know that Louis and Lestat was supposed to be gay. I knew that Lestat was a controlling maniac. That's what I knew, that he was a controlling maniac, but I didn't know why he was so controlling. And I really didn't know why he was a maniac. I understand. And so, well, let me just back. I don't even think Lestat is gay. I think in the film, we know that Louis is gay, because he's admitted it as such. He struggled with coming to terms with his sexuality, living in a time that was way more hostile. You could go to jail in the United States at the turn of the century for being queer, for engaging in queer acts, not necessarily for being queer, but for, excuse me, engaging in queer acts, or sexual acts, or actually not even sexual acts. Literally, you could go to jail for being perceived as being queer, right? That's in our history. That's in our history. If you don't know that, you should do yourself a favor and Google it. People born as women were going to jail for dressing as men outside of like a variety show. They had variety shows where men and women, people born as men and women, would dress in quote unquote opposite genders clothing, traditional clothing, and perform. But that was the only place that was acceptable. Anyway, outside of that, you could go to jail or worse, right? But it was, there were laws on the books. Anyhow, so I'm getting away from it because there's just so much to eat up. But so making Louis a black man, a black man of Creole origin, living in Louisiana, where specifically New Orleans, where one of the few places in the country at the turn of the century, and even a little bit before the turn of the century, where anybody that was perceived as being black or even biracial could have wealth and power and status, even in a city intermingling with white people. But that power and wealth and status had its limits. You were rich and comfortable as long as it was amusing, or you were amusing white people, rich white people. But the minute that you became a liability, the minute that you became not fun anymore, they ridiculed you, and they knocked you down a peg in leadership. They knocked you down a peg, and that's what we saw in the first couple of episodes, what happened to Louis while he was still clinging on to his humanness, the ways in which that he was knocked around. So like his family was reasonably comfortable, but they were still quote unquote colored. And they were always going to be reminded of that. They were Creole, but were always going to be reminded of it, which I think it's so funny for folks to, anyway, I won't go further off on a tangent. I will just say that it was genius to make Louis a Creole, a very visibly brown black man in New Orleans. And the relationship with sex work, his relationship with sex work, his relationship to his own sexuality, his relationship to his family, the fact that he was the breadwinner when the father had passed away, and the mother, who was extremely God-fearing and very prejudiced, still begrudgingly relied on her eldest to make ends meet for the family, that the entire family lived and ate off of what Louis, essentially sex work money. You know, like that whole conversation is just so interesting. You could live off that for a minute, but I recognize why the story had to take a pivot, because at the end of the day, the story isn't about Louis and his humanness. The story is about Louis and Lestat, and Louis coming to terms with the fact that he has to shed his humanness and now create his own life. And will or won't he create it with Lestat? And then you start to focus on the tragicness that is Louis loving, clearly being in love with a narcissist who is a philanderer. And we make our pivot to Lestat. I said in 90, when I was watching the film from 94, I didn't understand why. I knew that Lestat was a bad person. I knew that Lestat was just a maniac. I didn't understand why. Even though that was not my first movie, Interview with a Vampire was not my first exposure to the concept of vampires. I'd heard about the concept before. I'd even seen films from the 80s with vampires in it by that time. But there was something about his cruelness that I couldn't understand. And there was so much going on in the film that I was just enamored with the fact that, oh my gosh, vampires, and they live through the centuries and they adapt and all of that stuff. But you know, it was lost on me because I just hadn't lived any life, that the blessing of being human, or at least living on this spiritual plane, is that we all know it comes to an end at a certain point. And even though we will live, some of us will be blessed to live long, long, rich lives, we know that it will end. Even some of us won't live very long lives. All of us, though, regardless of the length of our life, we know that this plane has an expiration date. We just don't know it. But imagine if that was taken away and you lived indefinitely. And the only way that you could die, as far as you knew and the people around you knew, or people like you around you knew, is if particular harm came to you. And you understood the harm, but also you can stop that harm because you're big and bad enough to do it. So you have immortality with a caveat, but nevertheless, it's immortality. You have these abilities that enable you to make humans do whatever you want. You live a long time. I'm borrowing from an interview from the podcast, the official interview with the Vampire AMC podcast, where the guy that plays Lestat. My accent is terrible, but Lestat. I think it's Sam Reed. Anyway, the actor that plays Lestat reminded us, you know how in if you're going to follow the logic of vampires and you recognize that they've lived for centuries, you also understand, and I think this comes from reading the book as well, that they got to have their wealth from somewhere. They get their wealth from somewhere. They have to acquire it somehow. And what do we know about Lestat when we meet him? This is what we know. This is what we know even in the 94 film. In the 94 film, you get the sense that Lestat is a user. In this series, you get this, you know that Lestat is loaded. Now, in both of these scenarios, Lestat is an opportunist. It's just in the 94 film, Lestat is using Louis' money. In the series, the 2022 series, he inherited money from his maker, who made him and then died and left him with, quote unquote, a room full of money. And so, but you didn't even need to know that to know that when we first meet Lestat on the screen, he's moved from Europe by steamer to New Orleans and bought a house. It's not renting it, he bought it. And so you know he's loaded. And then we come to find out that he is loaded. And what's more, take a step back. Where is Louis when we meet him? And the reporter. He's in Dubai, secluded in one of those rich old high rises with buku dollars. And everybody knows. You go to Dubai, you gotta have loot to live there. Everybody can find a way to get there and visit, go on vacation and high post and perpetrate, but can't too many people actually live there, let alone live in one of those high rises, right? And not only that, but he has wait staff and stuff. So Louis is loaded by the time we meet him. When we're introduced to him for the first time, he's loaded, right? So we know that Lestat he has lived long enough to be able to know how to get money, whether it be from seducing it from the people that he hypnotizes or he uses his abilities on, or he's just cunning and watches the trends in the markets and acquires the money that way. Nevertheless, so just imagine You've lived centuries. We don't actually know. I think if you read the book, you know how old Lestat is. But I'm willing to bet he is hundreds of years old. So again, let's recap. You have no expiration date as far as you know. You don't know that you will die. You only know how you could die. And that you could live essentially forever as long as you were kept from particular harm that would end your life. That and direct sunlight exposure, right? You're powerful beyond your wildest dreams. You can manipulate humans into doing whatever you want them to do. And you can get money whenever you want. Wouldn't you be an absolute monster? Even outside of the fact that your sustenance is literally the liquid that runs through the people who you manipulate's veins. Even outside of that, wouldn't you be a monster? Yes, is the answer to that question. Power over life and death and poverty and aging and aches and pains? Are you kidding? People, relationships, you could literally create whatever relationship you wanted. Of course, you'll be an awful person. And so that's why Lestat is awful. Now, what I love about the series is it makes him awful with a purpose. You see that he's an awful person, but he's completely infatuated with Louis. And so he manipulates and he's shady as per usual, but he does it because he really wants Louis. And there's something redeeming about that, as horrendous and just detestable, despicable as Lestat is. That's a redeeming quality about him. I found no redeeming quality in the Lestat of the 94, of Tom Cruise's Lestat. There was nothing redeemable about him. What we know is they only got Claudia. He only got Claudia for Louis. But again, there was nothing. We were meant to believe that Louis was Lestat's companion, just his friend. You don't turn no child for your friend just because you don't want to be alone. Like the nature of vampires is to be alone. He wanted Louis. He wanted to be with Louis, not to be his friend, but to be his lover. And that's where the film lost me. But the series now lets me know, oh, this is why he endured. This is why he endured all the Louis's temper tantrums and is sulking, because he wants him some Louis. And so anyway, this show is bomb. It is not without its flaws, but this show truly is bomb. The accents could be better is the flaw. One of the flaws that I'm thinking about, the accents could be better. But nevertheless, oh my goodness, they do a good job. And we're coming up on the last episode, which means it's really going to be all the way live. The last episode of the first season. And what I love about, you know what I love about this more than anything? We're going to have a couple of seasons out of this thing, because while we've been introduced to Claudia and she's now lived years with Louis and Lestat, we're just now coming to the place where the three of them can't coexist. Certainly Claudia and Lestat cannot exist in the same space anymore. And it's at this point where we're reminded there's a reason why you don't see a ton of vampires hanging out with each other. The reason is very simple. These folks are vain, powerful, and jaded individuals. They don't need other people. They want other people for specific purposes, but they don't need them. They don't need community. They're superhuman. And so this community that Louis and Lestat have created with Claudia is unsustainable. It's unsustainable because Claudia and Lestat just do not get along. Fundamentally, they're essentially the same person. That's what I see. That's not what's portrayed on screen, but that's what I see. They're essentially the same person. The only difference is Claudia is a lot younger than Lestat. So she hasn't quite come into her own power. She's coming, but like she hasn't become as jaded as Lestat is. And unfortunately, you know how the story goes. You know that she's not going to, that her end is coming. Her end is coming because that's the nature of the story. But baby, this final episode of this season is going to be one for the books. And I'm already looking forward to how we're going to get where we need to go in season two. I think that this will really, truly go before it jumps the shark. I think this will absolutely go to five seasons before it gets dull, because there's so much subject matter to cover. So much subject matter to cover. Anyway, I'm just enamored with this show that I've literally, this is one of the few shows that I'm interested in rewatching the episodes, because there's just so much richness to it. So much story there. And it also makes me want to read the book, which I think I will do, is to read the book to get more context and to really, you know, see more nuance than perhaps what I'm getting even in the show, even though I'm enamored with this show. Yeah, so I could literally talk 4 hours about this thing, but I will not. What I will do instead is slide into, well, let me take a, so let me just say this. I would be a fool if I didn't just say this little caveat before I make the switch. I would be a fool not to note this monumental space that I'm walking into right now. Not only are we still dealing with the election results, the midterm election results, and the fact that Maryland just voted its first Black governor in history, in the history of the entire state, one of the oldest states in the Union, just elected its first Black governor, overwhelmingly so too. Maryland also legalized marijuana. Baltimore City also established term limits for city officials, which many people aren't happy about. Lots of things have happened here. What we know is that fortunately, Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker's race is headed to a runoff election on December 6th. But nevertheless, I'm glad that Raphael Warnock made it through despite the foolishness that is the Walker campaign. We also recognize that there are two governor's races were snatched by the Democratic challengers, and that the Senate is still up in the air on who in the heck controls that baby. So it's interesting times for sure. Lots of interesting times here. But in addition to this monumental election, Sigma Omega Sorority Incorporated is also, we are days away from, by the time I'm recording this, and even by the time this episode comes out, it will be 2 days before the sorority officially turns 100. This is, if you've been listening at all to this show for any length of time, you know I'm a member of Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated, and I am beside myself with excitement about this milestone. It is an interesting time to be alive. Two things. One, I will not see 200. It is a privilege to see 100 years of service for an organization that you belong to. And the second thing is, what an interesting time to be serving. I'm in leadership, not only in my organization, but in the NPHC in my city and, well, jurisdiction. And it's just an interesting time. It's an interesting time to be moving and shaking right now. It's an interesting time to be alive in this moment in time, to have the ability to do some things with the influence that you do have, with the circles of friends and associates that you do have. This is an interesting time that we're living in. I think I'm feeling the weight of it now, just because, you know, I'm stepping into this monumental celebration of 100 years of anything is something to be proud of. But not only that, but the fact that it is an historically Black sisterhood that was chartered in one of the most hostile places ever, in the middle of Ku Klux Klan territory in Indianapolis, Indiana, in 1922. And the fact that the things that those women were standing up against and creating a sisterhood for still do very much exist. I'm reminded of in a time where it is easy for people to judge people for being victims, judge people for their own circumstances, I'm just reminded that that's like an age-old thing. It's a thing as old as time. And it's an ugly truth about not only American society, but global society, that folks in power don't want you to remember. Folks in power don't want you to talk about. But how can you blame a person for their own circumstance, especially when it's completely out of their control? How can you blame a poor person for being poor when it's expensive to be poor? You literally pay more when you are poor than if you are rich. You are afforded more credit to spend and buy things you actually don't have the money to get, simply because of the promise that you will be in a better position to pay off. And what the hell is better? Excuse my language. Who determines better? Other rich people. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but this is just an interesting time. And maybe I'm just feeling super, super energized now because it feels like a lot of things are possible, because we're at the cusp of new, a lot of new things, interesting things. I'm an optimist at heart. I always will be. I think I'm a realist. I think I guard my own heart a lot, and I try not to get my hopes up. But at the end of the day, that hope just springs forth. You can't stomp it out, no matter how hard you try. No matter how hard I try, it's hard to stomp that thing out. And so anyway, there's a lot of things that we need to address. There's a lot of hard conversations that we need to have. I think here's another reason why I'm energized. I spoke to some Hopkins students last night, and I'm not going down that road. Anyway, I do love talking with people who are, that's exactly why I'm energized. Yes, it's I'm energized by the possibility of doing things and my ability to do things and our ability to get things done, and then celebrating what all has been done. Steps that were made, taken 100 years ago by women who couldn't have even imagined what the sisterhood would look like now. Yes, I'm completely energized by that. I'm also energized by the fact that I had a really great conversation with students last night who were asking me questions about practical application of the things that they're learning. And I could speak to it. The things that they're learning in their class, and I could speak to it. And I remember being in that seat, in the reverse, asking my professors questions about real world application, and not being able to get many answers, because they really weren't walking the walk, and they certainly didn't bring anyone in to do that too. And to be able to be what I wanted, what I wished was speaking to me when I was hungry and trying to find my way meant a lot. Because as it turned out, it took me a minute to get where I'm going. And I'm not saying that those students that I've talked to last night will magically know exactly where they're going and really be able to put theory into practice. That's a harder road. That's a harder road to walk, because you got to walk the path by yourself and figure out what works for you. You know what I mean? But I don't know. There was just something about the questions that they asked. And I guess it was just reinforcing that I'm on the right track. That I, yes, you do have the ability to get things done. Yes, you do have the ability to address things that you know you want to work on in your community to make it better. Even if, and this is the thing that I love most about my work, I don't have to see the end result. I just got to know that it's coming. My ego isn't that so big that I got to see the fruit of my labor. I like to know that, would I like a follow-up? Sure. But I don't need to know that it worked. I just need to know that the plans are in place for somebody to make it work, or that it will work soon. But I don't have to be there to see it. I think I'm going far down the rabbit hole, maybe I'll talk more about that. I don't know. Who knows? I don't want to talk about this anymore, because I will end up talking about it for an hour and I don't want to do that, but I think I just needed to get that off my chest, because I don't know if it's the social media. Actually, it is probably the social media that I engage in, the TV that I watch, the conversations that I have out in the community, in my circle, in my acquaintance bubble. Sometimes it feels like we're so overwhelmed that it's like, you know, and I know you felt this before, but sometimes you feel like, oh my goodness, what is this all for? And at the end of the day, it's all for the benefit of someone else. And sometimes that someone else is us. Even if it's not directly, it's all for us. This is why we do it. It's for us. Us is whoever you think it is. My us is the community. I love it. I eat it up. Because at the end of the day, you want to clean up in the house you want to stay at, right? You want your house to be nice. You want your house to be in order so you can feel comfortable, right? So what do? You pick up a broom. You plug in the vacuum. You push it around. You pick up those old newspapers. You put the clothes in the hamper. You know what I mean? You take out the trash. You light a candle. You fluff up the pillows. Okay, the analogy is finished. You get what I mean. And so anyway, I think I'm just super energized and I'm feeling like giving a pep talk, and I guess you got it. Anyway, but let me hasten on, because this is already long now, and I went long last episode for realsies, and I don't really want to do that this time, but the subject matter that I'm about to talk about, it's heavy, but I'm going to try my best to break it down in a way that makes it palatable. That said, if you're not into it, if you're not into hearing about, I'll give another trigger warning. If you're not into hearing about domestic violence, and certainly I'm not going to live there. I'm going to talk. It's a part of the story, but I'm actually going to have a bigger conversation. But if you're not interested in hearing about that because you're just not in a space to process the information or deal with it, I get it. Listen to another one of my episodes. I invite you to listen to the Out of Africa series, because actually next episode, I'm going to be talking about Wakanda Forever, and then moving into, I mean, we're well into November, and just talking about genealogy and ancestry and all of that stuff. So I'll talk about aspects of that next, that and pop culture. But anyway, yeah, there are other things that you could be listening to that are interesting. Listen to, you know what, I'm going to go back and listen myself. The episode where the Bayou Classic episode, where we did Thanksgiving in New Orleans, go listen to that. Oh, this Thanksgiving, we're going to South Carolina. So hopefully it'll be an interesting, episode that I'll have for you there. That'll be pretty cool. I'm very excited to do that. I wasn't sure that we were going to do it, but I'm excited to make that possible. Cause hubby is itching to go to the Carolinas, go back. He a country boy at heart, even though he born and raised in the city, middle of his heart is a grass field and blue skies. But anyway, so there's plenty of other content for you to listen to if you don't want to listen to this. But I promise you, if you stick around, I will be tasteful with this subject matter because I watched it. And I will tell you why I begrudgingly watched this thing. And then I will tell you about the subject matter because it is so fascinating to me. And I will say this before I move on. I like competition of any kind. I wouldn't say that I'm a sports fan. I'm a competition fan. And where do you get a lot of competition? From sports. Sports is an easy way to get competition. And so the subject matter of this documentary, I've watched this sport before and dabbled in it, to be honest with you, in high school. But anyway, I'll talk more about that in the next segment, which is going to be all about the Netflix documentary, Killer Sally. But again, the main subject matter, domestic violence, I will talk about it tastefully, but I definitely need to have a conversation because something struck me watching the thing, and I know it struck other folks too, and I want to talk it through. So anyway, next segment is all about Killer Sally. All right, let's get to it. So Killer Sally is a docuseries, three-part docuseries that aired from Netflix on November 2nd. It features Sally McNeil, who was a bodybuilder in the 80s. And it talks about the death of her husband, Ray McNeil, the fact that she took his life on Valentine's Day, 1995, after years of abuse. We watch the docuseries and we come to know that not only did Sally suffer abuse at the hands of Ray for many years, but that she suffered abuse from her children's father previously to that. And then previous to that abusive relationship, she was abused mercilessly by her father in the home. We also learned throughout the docuseries that the reason why she even got into bodybuilding is because of the military. And the only reason why she got into the military is because she was into sports and things because she was trying to please her father, her abusive father, who in her mind felt that she could never do anything right, never gave her any praise. And so her pursuit of praise led her to sports and a high achievement in sports, which led her to joining the military to seek higher heights and more accolades from her family, which led her to finding her first husband and having I don't even know if they got married, but her first partner and having two children. And then splitting with him and then finding Ray McNeil through bodybuilding, competitive bodybuilding, or at least amateur bodybuilding. And they marry shortly after they meet and they become this bodybuilding duo. She's taking championships in the women's arena and he grows to take championships in the men's arena. Their relationship is tumultuous. It grows to be tumultuous. He is abusive to the children. He's also abusive to her. And the docuseries, through Sally, mind you, through Sally, she, and I think this is something that she even used, there was a point in the trial, because certainly she was arrested and charged, went to court, and ultimately convicted for murdering her husband. And the details of that I'll share later. But throughout the docuseries, what we learn from her own words is that she alludes to his abusiveness ramping up and being more violent when he was preparing for a show, for a competitive bodybuilding show, when he was taking steroids. So in other words, the docuseries makes us think through Sally that he was an abusive person always, but he was more abusive when he was on steroids preparing for a show. And so what the Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1995, the day that she murdered him, he was preparing for a show, a competition that would be a couple of days in the future. And he had been doing his routine and following an abusive moment, she had had enough and she grabbed a firearm that was at her reach, and the outcome, it was that the children, she was arrested, Ray was dead, and the children were shipped back home to where she grew up in Pennsylvania to live with her grandmother, or with her mother, their grandmother. There's a moment in here where they briefly talk about the fact that Sally McNeil is white and her Ray McNeil was black, and that her previous partner was black and her children are biracial, and that she has a black best friend who was rooting for her throughout the case, and that she grew up in a town in Pennsylvania that was multicultural. I don't go to Netflix for education, or at least in docuseries about true crime, I don't go to them for education. It's entertainment. It's entertaining. It's shocking stories that they're telling. They're not doing a whole lot of good. And this is rude for me to even say, because how dare I? I don't do this for a living. It's not something that I've ever done, but I don't look at them to be investigative journalists in any way. Whereas a place like, I grew up on PBS. I'm a PBS kid to my core. Most of the documentaries I saw, if they weren't from PBS themselves, they were directly from HBO. And as complicated a relationship I have with HBO, for their lack of cultural diversity in their material or in the media that they put out, one thing about it is their documentaries, I might've questioned the subject, but I never questioned the approach and the thoroughness of the research. Now, mind you, I'm a child watching all of this stuff, but I never questioned the point of view. I questioned the why this person, but I never questioned whether or not they were biased, because quite frankly, HBO and PBS did this thing where they presented the information much like a news reporter would present the information, and they would ask the questions. And there were times where the subject, the person, would get agitated by the questioner. And, you know, that felt real to me. That felt authentic. And I don't even know if I've not gone back and looked at the documentaries that HBO released to see if I would think of them now the same way that I think of Netflix, but I feel like I learned something. I'll take, because when you talk about violence, you can't just talk about it for the sake of violence, or at least There has to be a purpose. What was the purpose? I can't tell you exactly what the purpose of the documentary of the Killer Sally, the purpose of Killer Sally, I can't tell you what the purpose of it was. But I can tell you when I watched American Violence, HBO's American Violence doc, that was narrated by Julian Bond, which was at the time, I believe the, if he was not the president of NAACP at the time, he was going to be. Went before the docu-series came out. But anyway, American Violence is one of the best stories that I've ever, the better documentaries that I've ever watched about a gruesome topic, which literally was the history of violence in the United States. Not a complete history of violence, mind you, but nevertheless, a telling of the United States' violent past through historical narratives from the people who were engaged in it themselves, or people who were the victims of the abuse, this particular type of abuse, literally. It is not for the faint of heart. It's not for light viewing. It's literally, I think it's like six episodes or something like that, six or so episodes. And each episode, if you're thinking about it like real life, because it is real life, it's hard to watch. Because in essence, we understand how the United States have become such a violent place. We love to think of other countries as being uber violent, and we love to assume that we're safe in our own bubbles, but you know, and that only things happen in the big bad city. But you know as well as I do that danger and trouble lurk around every corner. And you can be caught off guard if you want to, but the reality of it is this world is not a nice place. And every corner of the world can be impacted by the unpleasantness of our nature. Human nature. Anyway, that was a very sanitized way to say, to really kind of justify crime and violence. Okay. Anyway, but you get my meaning. Like, it's easy to just say that happens to you, y'all over there. That sort of thing doesn't happen here. And how many times have we heard that same sentiment shared? Anyway, but that docuseries was I've never seen a docuseries so thoroughly cover a gruesome topic so expertly and with, I won't say that it was unbiased, but I will say it was clear. It was biased, but it was clear, and I learned something from it. I don't know what I'm supposed to learn, what the viewer is supposed to learn from Killer Sally. You're presented with the information, but the information is incomplete. It feels incomplete. So this is a three-part docuseries. It's a three-part docuseries. The first episode is Valentine's Day. So it literally talks about, it leads up to the act, to Sally McNeil, ending her husband's life. Then it talks about the death of Mr. California, where you spend time learning about what led up to this incident, and certainly her being on trial, Sally being on trial, and then the people versus Sally McNeil is like the outcome. It's continuation of the trial itself, and then it's the outcome. And in the middle of learning about all of this, so many themes come up in my head. First, let me tell you, I was hesitant to watch this for two reasons. First, I don't watch docs on Netflix to learn something new. I don't go to Netflix to learn things, not in documentaries. And I think I've said that a million times already, or multiple times already, but I don't go there to learn from docs. Well, let me just clarify. To learn about an incident I've never heard of before, but I ultimately go do more research on my own about it, because at the end of the day, these docs really do come off as just telling a story. Whereas PBS and HBO felt like they were injecting information into it, statistics and things like that. I don't often, unless I'm tripping, I don't often see statistics being shared in HBO or Netflix docs. The only one I can think of is the Ava DuVernay one about 13th, but that was intentional. Like, and that was the director's response. Most of the docs on Netflix aren't, you're learning about something you might not have heard of before, but you're not necessarily getting supplemental information about the statistics. You're not getting what you would get from like a PBS or an HBO or anybody else, to be honest with you, because that's not what Netflix do. Unless it's driven, that information is driven by the directors themselves, the producers of the show, of the series themselves. So I didn't want to be entertained about domestic violence. I didn't want to. Also, I remember this story. I don't remember the details. I remember a woman who I thought was built, seeing some sort of TV show, some 90s version of true crime TV show, talking about this real life case of this woman who was a bodybuilder who murdered her bodybuilder husband, but come to find out he was an abuser. And ooh, what do we think about that? Like, did she do it because she had had enough, or did she do it to save her life? Like, because the answer to those questions are two very different ones. Like, they have they have different connotations. If you did it because you had enough, that implies that you could have left and you had other options. That's how they phrased it back then in the 90s. And if you were being abused at the time, you had no choice. And I remember shows talking about this real life case. I remember, I think SVU even did, like, not SVU, it, Law and Order, before it became the spinoffs in the early aughts and all of that. In the 90s, I think the original Law and Order had a case very similar to this, you know, because they ripped from the headlines as part of their thing. And so anyway, I remember being exposed to this in multiple different ways, but I was young. I was a preteen. I was a preteen in 95 when this happened. 96, 97, however long the trial took, I was a preteen moving into becoming a teen. Probably by the time she was sentenced, I was an early teen. I don't know what happens. Are you sentenced? So it happened in 95, February 95. I have to go back and look at the doc, but I could just literally pull it up, because so the event happened in 95. She was tried in 96 and convicted in 96. She got 19 years to life in 96. So yeah, I was a preteen when it happened, and I was still a preteen when it finished. But when she was convicted. But my point is, I was a young person. I was probably on the cusp of being a teen, wasn't I? 97? I don't remember. Yeah, it had to be 97. I was on the cusp of becoming. Yeah, well, I was still very much a preteen in 96. But I was still watching stuff that I should not have watched, but I'm glad that it did. It interested me. I love documentaries, and my love grew from watching doc on PBS and HBO. Anyway, while I watched content that probably should not have seen, I saw Hookers at the Point, y'all. Okay, I was sneaking and watching Hookers at the Point, not because they showed nasty, well, not, I called it nasty back in the time, but adult acts, Because they really didn't show adult acts. They showed people in silhouette doing what adults do. But it was more for the stories that I thought it was cool that they were shooting these stories of these people who were at the quote unquote underbelly of society at night. But anyway, I was watching Hookers at the Point. So, of course, I watched shows that I should not have watched when I was a child to help influence the things that I find intriguing now. But anyway, I've heard about this story before, but I never knew that she went to jail. I never, or prison. I never knew the outcome. I always knew what happened. And I thought, and to be fair, I thought I knew what happened. This docuseries, it reminds you that a person died and that another at someone else's hands. Ray died at Sally's hands. But I think it leaves a lot of open-ended questions as to exactly what led up to that. And that's what I want to, that's where I want to live. I want to live at talking about Sally and that incident. And I also want to talk about cycles. Where do I begin? So let's do this. So, well, no, you know, because you may or may not watch this. I encourage you to watch it, but this is what I'll say. This is what I'll say. Where Netflix falls short on this series, and certainly there are ratings about this series, and right now the ratings are super favorable. I don't feel comfortable rating a series, a docuseries, because it's not for I'm not trying to be entertained. I'm trying to understand something I've never understood before, or I've never been a concept. I'm hoping to understand or be introduced to a concept that hopefully by the end of the series I can know a little bit more about than I did before. Or you know what I mean? Like, I not only do I want to be introduced to something that maybe I haven't heard of, but I want to learn about it to the point where I can continue the conversation about it afterward. Because as far as I'm concerned, docs really should be to show us a side of life that maybe we ignore because we want to stay in this pretty bubble where violence happens to other people or bad things happen to other people. They don't happen to me. They don't happen to my people. I think it's dangerous to live like that. And so anyway, so I'm watching this series, and one of the things that strikes me is I feel like this series does the same thing to Sally that was done to her in the 90s, which is they want her to be a perfect witness. She even speaks to the fact that she's not a perfect witness. Perfect witnesses don't exist. They have an expert that says perfect witnesses don't exist, but they don't. I think this series, in trying not to take sides, but just present the information, ends up taking a side a little bit because it doesn't give Sally an opportunity to truly explain what happened to lead up to her taking her husband Ray's life. What we know in the court case, what we know from the series, and the court testimony is what I meant to say, is that Sally feared for her life. It's the reason why she left her first husband or her first partner. She feared for her life, and so she left her first partner. The docuseries alludes to the fact that when she was a child being abused by her father, that there were moments where she feared for her life, but it doesn't go deep enough. It doesn't, literally, they're essentially relying on Sally to tell her own story, which is a lot of work, which is a lot of hard work. The problem with this doc is there aren't a lot of reported cases of, there's not any supplemental information. It's literally just from Sally's perspective, which feels unfinished to me. You do hear from a few people in Sally's life, her two children, her best friend, her, her two children, her best friend, and some acquaintances of both her and Ray, but you never really hear more. The flaw in this thing is there's a story, but it's not being told well. I guess that's what I really want to say. It's not being told well because and it's a little bit, I don't know if it's reckless or not. I think I'm going through it, trying to process it now in my own head. But the doc does this thing where it asks, one of the questions that it asks is, what is a threat? What's the threat here? Was the threat that of immediate violence or immediate death, or was the threat that Sally was under was at some point, at any time, and I could never, at any time I could be killed at the hands of this man who lost his temper and decided to go off on me? And I think that's essentially one of the reasons why she was convicted, because it asked the question, society thought in the 90s, and probably still many people in American society anyway, probably still think today, the threat, I know they do, because look at all the cases, follow me for a second. Look at the cases of the young women who were trafficked, who ended up taking the lives of their abusers to get away. And look at how Santonia Brown, there's another young lady who was in a similar situation where she ended the life of her trafficker and was sentenced, punished for it, because in the eyes of the law, imminent danger is the excuse, is the only, the only rationale for an extreme response like taking someone's life. Imminent danger. And imminent means within moments. It's either you or me and again, I'm not a lawyer, but this is my perception of how the court and even the public kind of think about violence and what warrants extreme responses. Imminent danger. But I think what a lot of people miss when you're talking about domestic violence situations, and I'm never going to condone taking a person's life. But if you're going to sanction reasons and situations that, while doesn't excuse taking someone's life, it will draw a more sympathetic punishment. It's hard. If you've ever known someone who was in a domestic violence situation, or not domestic, intimate partner violence situation, because violence has no gender. Intimate partner violence has no gender. It's about power. It's about control. It's about power and control. If you've ever known anyone or ever encountered anyone, had a conversation with someone who was involved in a intimate partner violence situation, it's the constant state of, I never knew when it was going to happen, but for the most, I never knew when it was going to happen. I never knew exactly what would trigger it. It's just that it happened. And it was constant. And because I couldn't predict it, I was always walking on eggshells. And so in that situation, imminent. You can't put your finger on imminent because it's violence could strike at any time. So as far as you're concerned, the person who is imminent is all the time for them. It's not situational. It's literally my life. Do you know what I mean? And so the doc doesn't really answer the question. I guess it makes you answer the question, but legally the law is like, the law has not caught up to supporting people who are at the receiving end of intimate partner violence, as evidenced by the Centoya Browns of the world, as evidenced by the myriad people who are in custody right now, who are in prison right now for ending their partner's lives because the court said you could have walked away. Well, how can you walk away if you've been controlled psychologically? Now, if you've been manipulated by the person that you love. And we all know at this point, there's enough information out there for us to understand how grooming works, even love bombing. Love bombing works in relationships and how that is used by abusers and manipulators to draw you in and to endear you to them. And then as soon as when they feel like they've got you in their clutches, then they become their true selves. And so we see, I don't know that this series does not show you that. What this series does is, and maybe this is just my perspective, everything is subjective, but what this series firmly does is show you that Sally has gone from one abusive relationship to the next. And then there's a moment where she becomes abusive herself because she's learned it. They never allude to her being abusive to her children, but they allude to her being aggressive and abusive to people around her who have wronged her. And I don't know why that has any basis in the conversation. I just don't know. I was puzzled by that because even their approach to it was the sloppy ending. I will say this, it's a sloppy ending. That third episode, The People versus Sally McNeil. Or was it The People? Was it called The People versus Sally McNeil? Hold on. Whatever the third episode is, I think it is The People versus... I can't get the episode list. But anyway... The People versus Sally McNeil. I did all of that to say exactly what it was. Anyway, in that episode, we hear from Ray's friends who said that Ray was trying to get up out of that relationship. He wasn't. On the one hand, they say, oh, yeah, he had done some things by that time that was pretty aggressive. He worked as a bouncer and he blinded a person in a fit of rage, or in an incident, he blinded a person. Because he was that strong and that violent in that moment. But oh no, I've never saw him be violent to Sally. And so there's this air of doubt and you're like, well, who's telling the truth? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, throughout the entire series, you have Sally McNeil's kids talking about how violent he was. But then you also have the kids talking about how violent Sally got to people around her. And I just don't get it. Or to people outside of the family. And I just don't understand what I'm supposed to glean from that. What did we gain from knowing that Sally used violence against people who she thought were a threat to her children? Or in the third episode, we hear a lot about her going after the women that Ray was clearly cheating on her with. I don't know what we meant to glean from that, except that the state used that to prosecute her and successfully did so. Here's the other thing that we know from that night, and the docuseries brings up questions. And see, this is why I didn't initially want to watch this thing, but I'm glad that I stayed, because while I did not want to be entertained, while I did not want to, I just didn't want to watch something that wasn't going to have a purpose. I think this show, in watching it, I inadvertently found the purpose, or at least the purpose that I thought was a worthy one, which is showing the complicated nature of intimate partner violence. I think I mentioned earlier, Sally was a terrible witness. She's a terrible narrator. But here's why. Here's why she's a terrible narrator to her own story. She hasn't come to terms with a lot of her own past. She hasn't sought counseling. I don't think we know whether or not Sally sought counseling for the abuse that she endured, not only at the hands of Ray, not only at the hands of her previous partner and father of her two children, but her father. I don't think she's gotten any support for any of that. What's more, I think she was a combat veteran. I apologize. I don't remember that piece. But she suffered some violence in the military. In an aspect of her military service, she suffered violence. So she's got a lot of trauma that she's dealing with. And so she's not perfect in her recollection, largely because she doesn't want to think about it. Because that's what we do when we don't want to handle things, traumatic aspects of our past. We don't think about them. And even though she cannot forget February 14th, 1995, it's still difficult for her to really talk about it without guilt. As she, who wouldn't? Who, the way that she talks about it, it's she gets defensive, but at the same time, she's remorseful, and she's also like, but I guess the documentary is suggesting, and certainly the prosecutor suggests, what are you remorseful for? That you got caught? Or that you had to do it in the first place. Now the prosecution is suggesting that it's, you know, if she's remorseful for anything, is that she slipped up and she got caught. Sally, in her own words, says, she has a lot of complicated feelings about it, and I invite you to watch it to learn them. But if you watch this thing, you don't go in there expecting her to be a good witness for herself. She's not. She's dealt with too much trauma that she's not sought help for to be able to be a good advocate for her own self in this case. The other thing is, well, let me put a pin. So I will say that, well, let me finish this thought. What the documentary successfully does, and certainly this is what this is part of the prosecution's case, like not necessarily the linchpin, but it's a big deal. Ray was, according to Ray's friends, he was fixing to leave her and be with this other woman who he had been with for over a year or some long period of time. Valentine's Day night, two things were happening. So Sally said that she had made up her mind to leave Ray days ago because at any moment it was too violent. She didn't like who she was with him. And his rage against her had been escalating. And she left her previous partner when his rage had escalated. And so she was like, why am I still in this? I got to go. But at the same time, Valentine's Day night, she still expected to go have dinner with her husband. What we learn is that he doesn't come home until late. until much later. Like, he comes home. Well, I guess, do we know exactly when he... Basically, she's... The point is, she's all dressed up. Or she's not, maybe not all dressed up, but she's expecting to go out and celebrate Valentine's Day with him. That's a ridiculous idea. But nevertheless, have you engaged with someone who's romantically involved with someone who is an abuser? They have complicated feelings. They do. It's complicated. It's not perfect. It's all over the place. And how many times does it take? What do we know about how long it takes for a person to leave an abusive relationship? Several times. Several times they go back. In my own family, my aunt, who I love almost as much as my mother, whom I really, really love. I love me some my mama. And this, my one aunt, my one auntie, I loved her almost as much as my mama, which was a whole lot. She, in her last relationship, she left him five times before it took. Probably more than that, but I was a teenager. I didn't totally know how many times. I don't know. I just remember that I remember one time we moved her out of the place. Moved her out. I remember her living at the intersection of at a busy intersection. We moved her out. My daddy, my brother, one of my brothers, me, I was there. My mama was there. One of my uncles was there. The uncle I grew up with, he was there moving, helping, you know, getting her out. And I think one of her friends from work or something like that. And 3 weeks later, where was she? Back living with him. Back living with her abuser. He abused her. Financially abused her, physically abused her, emotionally abused her. And this was an extremely intelligent woman. But we're not talking about smarts. We're talking about emotions. We're talking about being manipulated. Anybody can be manipulated. Anybody can. That my aunt's situation taught me that. Because when I tell you, she and her siblings, my mama, all of them are brilliant people. Believe me, they're brilliant people. Getting patents on things and all of that. But baby, when I tell you, a master manipulator cannot have a dime to their name, not nary a degree, but still make you feel less than, and you got 3 degrees. Because that's how manipulators are. Abusers even are like that as well. And so anyway, yeah, it's complicated. Yeah, she had intended on leaving this man because it was super violent, but also she wanted to be with him on Valentine's Day and he did not come home. And so he did not come home when she thought that he should have, so that they could go out. But not only that, what we learned is that he was out with this other woman on Valentine's Day and not his wife. And so an argument ensues. He's physically violent with her. And then it's perceived that according to the prosecution, the moment passed. And then Sally grabs the firearm and takes his life. That's what the prosecution presents. And certainly based on the testimony of some of his friends, and then also the fact that she's a bodybuilder and she did wrestling and things like that, they painted her as someone who intentionally did this because she was mad at him. And I think that's the wrong approach. I think there are plenty of examples of people of any gender, of any sexual orientation, manipulating people and punishing them when they don't get their way. This isn't one of those situations to me. This is one of those situations. It's complicated and it's messy. And people want to demonize her because I said it before. She's a messy narrator. She's not a good storyteller. She's not even a good advocate for herself. But if you know anything about intimate partner violence, none of it is clean. None of it is clear. There are no clear. There's nothing is clean and clear. And so I think I'm annoyed by this doc, because in trying to tell her story, I don't know that it goes far enough, but it makes the lines clear enough. But I don't know, maybe if I go back and I watch those PBS docs or those HBO docs, I find that those series were really heavily one-sided. I don't know. It's just, this one feels more nuanced and more complicated than I feel like the direction as a viewer we were given. I don't think we were given any direction, really. We were given a bunch of information, and the information that we ended up with was less favorable on Sally. And so here's what we ended up knowing. This is the other thing that I wanted to, I'm glad that I ended up watching it. It's like it pulled up really great points. It did not do a good job of talking about Sally. I think it's pretty clear she was a woman who had been abused, and she saw an opportunity to end the abuse. How you get there when you watch it is up to you, because certainly the prosecution, Ray was shot twice, and that's all I'll say. That Ray was shot twice. I'll leave it up to you to watch it to figure out, to make your own conclusions. I think this is a messy, complicated story, but all intimate partner violence stories are. None of them are clean. And that is not to say that a victim ever deserves, and I want to be clear, nobody deserves to be a victim of domestic violence or intimate partner violence. Nobody does. What I'm saying is sometimes we act against our own best interest. That's what I mean when I say, no, this is a messy story. We act against our own best interest most of the time because we just want, I can accuse my own self of this, being engaged in conversations. Well, no, I don't want to trivialize. You understand what I mean. Sometimes we are our own worst enemy because we just want to see a thing through, or if we just do X, Y, and Z, it'll be better, and better never comes. But we just want an opportunity for better to come. And before you know it, it's been years. You know what I mean? Anyway, but so I'm glad to see an imperfect person talking about this story, because at the end of the day, I don't think we see it enough. In different types of people who to tell their story. Anyway, because to be honest with you, if we don't see it enough, our response will continue to be the same. Again, we'll continue to put the Santoya Browns in prison without really understanding the nuances to their story. We just will. Because we still look at... Anyway, that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah, if we don't see the Santoya Browns of the world like the victims that they are, or not to... The exploited people that they are, if we don't see the Sally McNeils as the exploited people that they are, we will continue to prosecute the exact same way. Anyway, but the other thing that I wanted to say that struck me about this series was the children and their response to it. I don't think I've ever seen a clearer response or a more... I don't think I've ever heard as much detail about the life of a child of someone whose parent was an abused person. I don't think I ever have. I don't think I've known anyone in my life to talk about that. I've known people in my life who've been abused, and I've known abusers. But I don't think I've ever had a conversation with the children of that type of relationship. If I did, we never talked about it. And so listening to these Sally's children speak and their approach to it broke my heart, especially when you consider that both of them repeated the cycle. What cycle am I talking about? The cycle of abuse. Sally's daughter was engaged in an abusive relationship that she got away from, thank God. Sally's son all but alludes to the fact that he was an abuser. All but says he was an abuser to his partner, his first wife. But is a person who is trying to turn over a new leaf and is desperately trying not to be what he used to be. And I just think of the cycle of violence and how the person who is the target of the bulk of the abuse is not the only person impacted, especially if there are children in the picture, and how those relationships can repeat themselves over and over and over again. It's frustrating. It's frustrating. I think this series, I'm glad that this series exists. I'm glad that her story is there. I'm glad that we got to hear from the children. I don't know what will come of this. I have complicated feelings about this, other than the fact that we need to turn to organizations like House of Ruth in Baltimore. I don't know if House of Ruth exists outside of the state of Maryland, but the Houses of Ruth globally, who not only support women who are people who are escaping intimate partner violence situations, but also then in their own way, and I still have complicated feelings about this, and I got to be honest with you, I'm completely biased. I've known abusers in my life, and I've cut ties with them as soon as when I learned. And that's a me thing. That's not anyone else's thing. I know that that forgiveness and is a thing, and people change. People can change. People have the capacity to change. I'm just not at a place where I am open to engaging with someone who was an abuser but isn't anymore, because I'm not there where I believe rehabilitation is possible. And that's a terrible thing to say, and I know that. It's just the complicated feeling that I have right now. I know I need to sit with that and kind of think it through, but like, it's just not something that I'm accepting right now. And so, but I do appreciate the Houses of Ruth's of the world, the House of Ruth's of the world. It's called House of Ruth. And then I respect entities like them that exist globally, because not only do they support people who, victims of intimate partner violence, and help them get on their feet, help them gain their own independence and start anew, but then they also offer opportunities for abusers to re-educate themselves, which I think is a noble cause. I'm just not convinced that it works. And I just need to do the work myself. I need to do the work myself and looking at that, because that's that complicated piece of me. But I appreciate that they offer opportunities for people to grow and change. I certainly would want a opportunity to grow and change. It just feels like, I don't know. Anyway, largely because I've known too many people who've suffered at the hands of domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And again, I said the people that I've known that have been the abusers, the minute I've found out, I've cut them out. So anyway, which leads me to my final point. I think the reason why I didn't want to watch this is because I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to think the things that I'm thinking right now, because it makes me think of my aunt and what she went through. I told y'all this story. I've shared this story before, but it makes me think of the situation. I can't remember what episode I've shared this story, but the situation where it was between her breaking up with her husband that she ultimately left from, who was abusive. It was in one of those moments where she wasn't with him, and she was supporting her homegirl who was divorcing her husband because he was probably, let me not get to lying. I don't know why she was divorcing him, but she was getting away from him. And my aunt had gone over to see her homegirl, and her ex-husband, or soon to be ex-husband, if they were living in an apartment, it was downtown Kansas City, I believe. Not downtown, but like the plaza. Because my auntie lived on the plaza, and I think her homegirl lived on the plaza too. And back in the day, that was where you would, you know, that was, you was fruitful life. Anyway, and she's how I remember my aunt telling me, and I think my mama corroborated the story. And one of these days, I'm just going to go look it up, find the story, looking it up online. But my auntie went to go visit her, and they were chopping it up, and whoop, whoop, whoop. Ex-husband, or soon to be ex-husband, but bursts through the door, or at least comes through the door. They're about to get into it, but instead of getting into it, he has a rifle. Here come my auntie, because my auntie was tall and bout it, but he was just full of rage. And anyway, he battered my auntie with the rifle and knocked her out so he can get to his soon to be ex-wife. And you know what happened. And I remember my auntie testified after she got well, or she was well enough to testify, she did that. And I believe he was convicted and went to prison. We got a complicated relationship with intimate partner violence. We know that it shouldn't happen and no one deserves to be a victim, but we don't do things. We don't put controls in place to protect folks from this, from outcomes like that of my auntie's friend. Now, anyway, that's probably more nuanced situation than I realized, because I don't know the history. Was this the first time? Did she have a protective order? I don't know any of that. I just remember what happened that pulled my auntie into it. And so anyway, the reason why I didn't want to watch this thing also, because I didn't want to have to think about those feet. I didn't want to feel that right now. But nevertheless, these stories do need to be told so that we can be better at responding to them. They do. And so, as imperfect as this one is, I'm glad it's out there. I'm glad that at the end of it, I will share that she's found peace. She's out of jail and she's got peace. Her children, we don't know. Their stories are still happening. Their stories are still unfolding. They're both adults. in their 30s, I think, at this point. Their stories are still evolving. I hope for the best for them. And yeah, this, if you're not ready to feel things, if you're not ready to talk about a heavy subject, this doc isn't for you. But if, I think it's worth watching. I do think it's worth watching. Because we need stories like this, not pretty, very ugly stories like this, to put a fuller picture on what intimate partner violence looks like. Well, at least the many faces of it. That's what I'll say. Anyway, all right, this was a heavy topic. Next week, I'm talking about Wakanda Forever, because hubby and I are going to watch it Sunday night after all of the centennial festivities. But anyway, yeah, if you have any thoughts about this series yourself, you're welcome to share those thoughts. I've been open the door, so let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. But in the meantime, I hope you are well. Take care of yourself, protect your own peace, be good to the people in your life. And you don't have to go, you don't have to stay long at the place if you don't want to. Talking about Thanksgiving is coming up. You don't have to stay in that room for very long. You can go say what's up to who you want to say what's up to and then be out. You don't have to speak to everybody. You don't. I know what they say. I'm telling you, you got your own power and ability to do what makes you, you got to protect, you are the only one responsible for protecting your own peace, and you got to protect it fiercely. All right, that's it for now. Have a wonderful day, evening, or night, depending on when you're listening to this. Until next time.